The Cycling Podcast, powered by Super Sapiens. Energy management for committed athletes and coaches.
Where are we, Lionel?
Well, Richard, this is a great honour to have you here in Watford. The first time the Cycling Podcast has ever recorded in Watford. Not Watford. This is actual Watford. Real Watford.
This is not Watford, in fact, to be accurate. I can't believe it. It's such an honour to be here. It's incredible, the breathing, the air of Watford.
What's it like? What do you make of it?
I can't say I've explored it too much, Daniel. I literally stepped off the train and crossed the road and went into a kind of cafe/business centre type place. And that's where Lionel and I are perched rather awkwardly at the moment and hooked up with you in Berlin. And it's Daniel Freeb. Hello, Daniel.
Hello, chaps. What's the local speciality in Watford?
Flat white, Daniel. Daniel's got his head in his hands. Oh. It's great. Great to be here. Where's the football ground from here, Lionel? Do you know?
Well, it's straight up there, probably about a mile's walk from here.
This makes great radio.
See the floodlights.
Straight up there.
Well, it's straight up the main road from where we are, Richard. I'm actually here in real life with Richard for the first time since last year's Paris-Roubaix. We should explain, normally Richard's based in northern France, but you've come over to the UK for a visit, and we thought we'd do the podcast face to face. And we've been met with a number of challenges today because there's been a big storm across the UK, and the train that I would have taken from my home base in Not Watford into central London to meet Richard, the trains have all been cancelled, and so I was unable to get into London. So Richard has come to Watford. He's actually come to me here, more or less. And as I say, I'm very honoured. But you'll see the football ground when you get back on the train to go back to London, Rich. The floodlights will be to your right. The home of not terribly good football at the moment, unfortunately.
Well, it's a great privilege to be here. I mean, every storm cloud has a silver lining, doesn't it? And it's brought me to not Watford for the first time in my life, possibly the last. I don't know. Who knows? So enough Watford chat, Daniel. I can see your eyes are glazing over already. So God knows what the listeners are thinking. There's lots of racing to talk about.
We haven't even started talking about cycling yesterday. Usually my eyes start glazing over when we talk about cycling, but...
Well, what are we going to be talking about in this episode, Daniel?
Well, Rich, it's a continuation of the already rip-roaring start to the racing season. There have been various races taking place across Europe and further afield over the last few days. We're going to have a bit of a roundup, aren't we? We're going to pick out some of the key talking points. There have been some talking points away from the racing. Chris Froome advocating. Was he advocating that time trials be banned? I hope he was. I suspect it was his point was really restricted to the bikes on which time trials are ridden, but he suggested that they're dangerous. This, of course, is in the wake of the Egan Bernal accident a couple of weeks ago, so we're going to be discussing that. Should time trial bikes be banned? We're also going to be hearing from the manager, the head honcho, the big kahuna of Jumbo-Visma, Richard Plugger, aren't we, about that team's season, Primoz Roglic. And we're going to be hearing from someone who has just left Jumbo-Visma, George Bennett, and who has sort of been sleeping, or he's sleeping with the enemy, as it were. He's linked up with Tadej Pogacar at UAE Emirates, and George Bennett is about to make his debut, I think, for that team in the next few days at the UAE Tour.
Alongside Tadej Pogacar, indeed. Lionel, before all that, do you have a news roundup for us, please?
I certainly do, Rich. Yes, it's been a week of COVID cases, sprint relegations and a disqualification. I mean, we're getting to a point where it's going to be easier to list the riders who haven't had to pull out of races because of COVID. Just a few of the headlines this week. Richard Carapaz pulled out of the Tour de la Provence. Vincenzo Nibali had to scratch the Ruta del Sol. The entire Le Col Wahoo team is out of the women's Volta Valenciana. And we've just heard this morning that Fernando Gaviria is out of the UAE Tour, which is an unwelcome flashback. 2 years ago, when pro cycling and COVID first collided, Gaviria was one of the first high-profile cases, wasn't he? And spent quite a bit of time in hospital. It feels
this
like...
This is his third positive
That's
test.
That's right. He's been really unfortunate. He will be replaced in the UAE Team Emirates lineup by Pascal Ackermann. Not a bad replacement in sprinting terms. We're going to discuss the racing in the first part. There has been a lot of racing going on. It strikes me as no coincidence that the teams at the bottom scrapping for their World Tour licenses, Cofidis, Lotto, Intermarché and Arkea Samsic, have all been impressive in the early weeks of the season. At the Tour de la Provence in southern France, Nairo Quintana of Arkea Samsic won there for the second time in his career. He won the final stage on the Montagne de l'Eure to dislodge Filippo Ganna, who had led since the opening time trial. Ganna was then disqualified, we are pretty certain for an illegal bike change, where he took a different bike from a predetermined point on the side of the road rather than from the team car. He didn't appear in the final result. Also in the south of France, Elia Viviani got his first win back with Ineos. They were Team Sky when he last rode for them, of course. That was probably the most eye-catching day of racing because the crosswinds in the Camargue really split things to bits. And Brian Coquard's got more wins for Cofidis this month than he's managed in the past 2 years. Meanwhile, at the Tour of Oman, a big win for Jan Hirt of Intermarché. He and Fausto Masnada won the two hillier, more challenging stages. Mark Cavendish is off the mark.
Jan put everyone in the Hurt locker.
Oh, excellent. I missed that one. Mark Cavendish is off the mark, getting his first race win of the season. But he had a funny old final day. He was docked some points for pushing off the medical car three times during the stage. He was then impeded in the final sprint by Max Richese of UAE Team Emirates, whose teammate Gaviria won just as he had on the first day of the race. More success for UAE at the Vuelta Murcia, where Alessandro Covi gave them a 1-2 ahead of his teammate Matteo Trentin. Alexander Kristoff, another Intermarché rider, won the Clásica Almería, and King of the Gravel, Alexei Lutsenko, won the Clásica Jaén Paraíso. Now, the big question we'll discuss is whether that is a performance worthy of the Cycling Podcast Performance of the Year, powered by Cassulet, currently held by Brandon McNulty, of course. The racing's carrying on. It's the holiday swing this weekend, isn't it, with the Ruta del Sol and the Tour of the Algarve. You can almost taste the sangria and sardines. We'll talk about how those races have got underway. There was another relegation in the sprint for Jordi Meus in Algarve, where Fabio Jakobsen won his third race of the season. Away from the racing, a few headlines to run through. The Tour de France wildcards have been confirmed. Alpecin Fenix, Arkea Samsic, and then the two French teams, B&B Hotels and Total Energies, will join the rest of the World Tour teams at the Tour de France. Some big news for Milan-San Remo, because the Turchino is back after 2 years, and the race will also start at the legendary Vigorelli Velodrome. Confirmation that there will be women's under-23 world titles on the road from this season, with standalone events coming in 2025. Matt White went to the Super Bowl. Did you see that? He was supporting the LA Rams. I saw that on social media. I hope he had a good time there. Our very good friend Simon Gill has finished third in a photography competition run by Strava, the Year in Sport competition. His picture of a mud cake, Tosh van der Sander, from the end of Paris-Roubaix took third place. His second podium finish for Simon in photography competitions, just with his pictures from Paris-Roubaix alone, because he was also third in a competition before Christmas with his picture of Lizzie Deignan celebrating her win in Roubaix. And three other talking points. Cyclocross, there was a race in Belgium, a super prestige race, where they trialled drone footage flying behind Lucinda Brand, the eventual winner of the race, and the drone was banned from competition midway through on the technicality that the organisers had not got prior permission from the UCI. But from March the 1st, drones will be allowed to film cyclocross races as long as the organisers get clearance in the first place. And it seems to me that's a good environment to try out drone photography at races. What do you reckon?
Have either of you chaps seen any of this 8G, I think it's 8G camera footage that's being used in the Spanish Football League for when the players come out on the pitch? It kind of makes everyone look as though they're sort of figurines in FIFA 2022.
It's quite I have not
curious.
Seen that.
I wonder if we'll see.
But is that where we're going? Because so we're sort of seeing enhanced, sort of filtered images coming through our TV screens sometime soon, are we?
Possibly. Possibly, yes.
So rather than the Zwift graphics getting more and more realistic, real life is just going to get more and more computerized. Is that the trend?
Crossover at some point.
Yeah. I mean, I can certainly see a place for drones in the filming of cycling, but we also need to be a little bit wary in this rush. I mean, imagine how loud the outcry will be if there were to be some kind of incident. You know, the first time a drone drops out of the sky into the middle of a race, or heaven forbid, were to collide with a rider just through operator error, you know, it's another variable, isn't it? It's another unpredictable factor being introduced into proceedings. So I don't really blame the authorities for proceeding with caution here.
Yeah, there have been a couple of incidents, or there was certainly one incident in skiing. Drone footage has been experimented with in skiing in a slalom in 2015. There was a drone that dropped out of the sky and hit a skier. I don't know sort of what the postscript to that was. I haven't been watching too much of the Winter Olympics. I'm not sure if you've been able to sort of ascertain, tell whether the drones are being used there.
I don't know. Sure.
Roglic got a bronze, I think, in the ski jumping.
But just on danger and drones. Oh, sorry, Lionel, did you have another punchline there? On danger and drones, you know, in the long term, could we not see drones also replace TV cameras on motorbikes and even stills cameras on motorbikes and actually take the motorbikes out of the race, which would remove one potential and real danger? And then in the longer term, could we see drones carrying spare bikes? You know, just take all the vehicles.
Well, do you know who we should ask? You know who we should ask about this? Our good friend Gianni Savio, because his team is now sponsored by a Spanish manufacturer of drones for industrial uses mainly. In fact, there have been some really interesting articles in the Spanish press about the military purposes that these particular drones are being used for. So perhaps Gianni would be able to provide some insight into this.
And any drone experts out there want to give us their take on the practicalities or the sort of the timescale for seeing drones being replacing some of the vehicles in races, motorbikes in particular. We'd love to hear from you.
Why not go the whole hog and just replace the riders with drones? Anyway, enough droning on. Two more little items of news. Sticking with the cyclocross, Toon Aerts has tested positive for a metabolite of a breast cancer drug. This test was taken 10 days before the World Championships, where he finished sixth. There's no medical use for letrozole in men, apparently, and it's banned because it can be used to mask the effects of anabolic steroids and other things. But Aerts will have a chance to plead his case. And
I was reminded yesterday, chaps, by a good friend and colleague of ours, Jan-Peter de Vlieger, a Belgian journalist, that this is the same substance that the Italian tennis player Sara Errani tested positive for. One of her defences initially, memorably, was that the a pill had dropped into her mum's tortellini. She was making some lovely field pasta at home, I think somewhere in central Italy, and she thought that maybe they had been contaminated.
Wow. And finally, Domenico Pozzovivo, who rode last year for Quebeca Next Hash and had not got a contract for this season, has signed for Intermarché. He is 39 years old and turned pro back in 2005, but another year, one more year for Pozzovivo. And we'll have to see if he lines up at the Giro d'Italia a little bit later on this season.
When he turned professional in 2005, he also had a different name. He was also called Pozzovivo then. And he changed his name by whatever the Italian equivalent of Dipol is. Because Pozzovivo means sort of lively stink. And it now means sort of lively well. Pozzovivo is more lively wishing well.
The Cycling Podcast, powered by Super Sapiens. Energy management for committed athletes and coaches. And now you can wear the Super Sapiens Energy Band, the first and only wearable that can display real-time glucose data directly from Abbott's LibreSense Glucose Sport Biosensor. The Super Sapiens Energy Band is available at supersapiens.com for €159.
Thanks very much indeed to our title sponsor, Super Sapiens. We're very grateful to them for their support across all of our podcasts. Last year, we ran a couple competitions for listeners to win 3 months' worth of Super Sapiens devices. One of those winners was Ed Pugh. His wife, Jane, had nominated him for his work during COVID. He's an anaesthetist in a hospital in Newcastle. And Ed got his 3 months' worth of Super Sapiens. Let's hear a little bit more about how he got on with them.
My name's Ed. I've just turned 40 and I work as an anaesthetist. When I've been doing Zwift riding, which is fairly sort of high intensity for me most of the time, I've been really interested to see that my blood glucose drops very dramatically when my the sort of higher end of my exercise, if I'm doing the sort of the zone 5 maximum heart rate, which for me is pretty much 100% of the time on Zwift. It's really shows a significant dip down if I don't fuel myself. So I've been looking at how I can fuel what with and what time to sort of make sure that I'm not getting those dips, which will probably feed through to, poor performance as the time goes on. So that's how I've been kind of using it at the moment. I've not been doing as much sort of endurance riding just because of the sort of winter conditions, but I'm planning to do a longer ride coast to coast later this year. So I'll be definitely interested in fueling to stop, to make sure that I can actually complete that in one piece in one day.
Well, chaps, there's been so much racing. Provence already seems like quite a long time ago, but we should maybe start with Provence. Nairo Man, we've seen him in this kind of blistering form in the early season in the past. And he showed it again. It's part of a trend.
Nairo Man, no es un ciclista, es Nairo Man.
Second verse?
I think they're the only lyrics. This I can't remember the name of the commentator, but this has become a famous refrain on Colombian TV. Nairo Man, Nairo Man. He's not a cyclist. He's Nairo Man. Being the translation.
Well, he was a very good cyclist in Provence and rode very well. But it's part of this trend that we're seeing at the moment, or this phenomenon in the early part of the season of very strong starts from these teams that we expect to be scrapping for World Tour licenses. Arkea Samsic, he rides for. But Intermarché have been on fire. Alexander Christophe in Almeria, Jan Hurt in Oman. They've started the year very strongly. Is there any explanation for that beyond this expected battle for the World Tour licenses? And what did you make, Daniel, of Nairo Man in Provence?
Well, as far as Nairo Man is concerned, I think he and his team and pretty much everyone else was quite surprised because he had COVID quite badly over the winter and suffered quite a lot and lost at least a couple of weeks of training. And he's really coming to the season with a bang. A similar performance to the one we saw from him on Mont Ventoux, also in the Tour de Provence when he last won it. But it's interesting, isn't it? Just thinking about him coming into the last year of this 3-year contract with Arkea, which was sort of supposed to propel them towards the World Tour and really the next level in every regard. And it kind of has done that. And I think he's settled relatively well and he's made a lot of effort to integrate himself. But there are still those who will say that Arkea haven't got out of him everything that they wanted and expected. And, you know, even at the weekend, the team manager, Emmanuel Hubert, talked about Nairo still thinking that he could win the Tour de France, still wanting to win the Tour de France. And Hubert's words in response to that were, "I'm not going to be the guy to shatter his dreams," which sounded a bit like sort of backhanded, well, I don't know, fatalism, really. But that's Quintana's conviction. I mean, in the sort of final analysis at this stage, 2 and a bit years into this 3-year deal, which was supposedly, you know, it was a package with other riders and support staff arriving as well, supposedly €5 million a year. I mean, do you think it's been a success or a failure? And do you think he could stay there beyond this season?
I mean, he started off in 2020 very, very well for them. And I think we could see also through the famous Movistar Netflix documentaries how at times he was a square peg in a round hole at Movistar. And I think we thought that in a new environment, we might see the best of Nairo Man. And 2020 started really well. And I remember we were talking about him finally perhaps fulfilling that potential that he had with RK Samsic. Then, of course, COVID came along. We pretty much lost the season. He wasn't the same when racing resumed. And he had a poor year last year. But he did look very good. I mean, okay, it wasn't a very deep field. There was Julian Alaphilippe putting up a challenge, but it wasn't a field full of top climbers, certainly not full of Tour de France contenders. So it's difficult to judge, but he did look very good. Very punchy, very dynamic, because we've often in the past bemoaned the fact that, you know, he's not been that sort of rider. He's more of a diesel. But here he was on the attack, really laying it down, and he looked good, and that's all we can really go on at the moment, isn't it?
He did indeed, Rich. And one thing, you know, we've always said about Quintana is that he's a fighter and he's fought through a lot of adversity, whether it be injuries or, you know, people kind of losing faith in him over the last few years. And he always clings on, you know, at the Tour de France. He's a guy who almost never abandons races. And, I haven't got the list in front of me, but if you sort of enumerate all of the summit finishes that he's won in his career, I mean, it's an incredible collection of some really kind of mythical, legendary climbs in the sport. And, you know, the Montagne de Lourdes is not a particularly famous mountain in cycling, but it is a kind of famous mountain in Provence. And it's another feather in his cap that's been added.
Yeah, I mean, as you say, Rich, echoes of 2020 when he won the Tour de la Provence and then followed it up with overall victory in the Tour des Alpes Maritimes et du Var, and then with a stage win at Paris-Nice, which was then curtailed as COVID swept across Europe, wasn't it? And I remember talking at the time about maybe this is Quintana, as you say, unshackled from Movistar, without that pressure of being part of a trident, or having, you know, too much responsibility on his shoulders in a sort of part of a team, I guess, an undisputed leadership role. But these are smaller races, aren't they? And we've seen over the last couple of lockdown affected years that, you know, when it's come to the Tour de France, he's had some bad luck. I mean, crashed as well, hasn't he? And sort of struggled through one of those tours. But he's 32 now, so it's an encouraging start to the season, but I don't think it necessarily says that he'll be a Grand Tour force this year when it comes to the overall, but certainly a very dangerous rider in the mountains and, you know, potential stage winner. But what else caught the eye in Provence? Because we were in a very unusual situation for one reason or another, where we actually watched stage one, which was split to ribbons by the crosswinds and won by Elia Viviani as it swept around the windswept Camargue. We watched that together, didn't we? And we were chatting away whilst the cycling was unfolding on the screen in front of us. It was a most enjoyable experience that afternoon. And as we were talking about that race, it was basically served up to Viviani, wasn't it? Given an armchair ride to the finish. I mean, he would have had some questions to answer had he not finished that one off. But nevertheless, a good victory for Viviani, for Ineos. And then what's happened to Brian Coccar? You're talking about the relegation-threatened teams. Cofidis are one of those. And Coccar has, he's hit the ground running this season, hasn't he, after a couple of barren years. And then there was a curious disqualification for Ganna on the final day.
Sorry, I was just going to say, Lionel, on Coccar, he's had these wins, but arguably as, if not more impressive, his second place to Jakobsen on the first day in Algarve yesterday. We're recording on Thursday, so that race is still going on, but a really remarkable, I don't want to skip ahead and we'll go back to Ghana in a moment, but a really remarkable finish to that stage with Remco Evenepoel doing real damage, at one point pulling four Quick-Step riders away from everybody else. Jakobsen, a similar experience to Viviani on stage one in Provence, where he really had to win, and he did very convincingly, but it was a real fight to get to be in contention for that sprint finish, and Coquard did extremely well to be there, which suggests that it's not flash in the pan. He's raised his level. He's going extremely well. And yeah, if Cofidis, the resurgence of Cofidis, another of the plot lines. But yeah, Ghana, apart from the disqualification for the illegal bike change, looked very good as well, and is one of the bright spots of the Ineos early season, which hasn't had loads of bright spots, but Ghana's form certainly one of them.
I mean, the grave danger at this time of year, and this will speak to you, Lionel, it applies to Nairo Man and it applies to Ghana, is that people will speculate and extrapolate to a disproportionate sort of degree. And as far as Ghana is concerned, people might look, notwithstanding his disqualification, they might look at his performance on the final day, on the final climb, Montagne du Lourd, when he finished about a minute behind Quintana, didn't he? Or a little bit more than a minute. And this will crank up the hype machine or the speculation about possibly Ghana becoming some kind of GC rider in the future. And he's even sort of vaguely alluded to that possibility. I mean, I don't know what you chaps think, but the sort of history, the recent history of professional cycling is scattered with a litany of sort of broken dreams, broken or parts of careers that have been ruined or to some degree compromised by riders trying to reinvent themselves, whether it be, you know, reinvent themselves as classics riders having been sprinters or reinvent themselves as GC riders having been time trialists. And, you know, I was just thinking about some of the time trialists who have sort of nibbled at this idea of becoming GC riders. You know, Cancellara, Tony Martin, we talked about the other day. Rowan Dennis has, you know, to a certain extent as well. Wout van Aert, people would like him to try. And I just think that it is a bit of a vain, a futile pursuit. And I ultimately think that will be the case with Ghana as well. You know, it was one climb at the end of a four-day race. It was 4 days, wasn't it? I don't really think you can read much or anything into that. I mean, just looking at Ghana's weight, he's 82 kilograms. He could lose 3 or 4 kilos. Probably the heaviest Grand Tour riders, Grand Tour winners of the last 20, 30 years have been around about that weight. Miguel Indurain, it was a very different time in cycling. And I think that, you know, the capabilities of heavier riders were enhanced in that period, shall we say. Francesco Moser won the Giro in 1984. He weighed about the same, 82 kilos. But I don't.
And he got in a helicopter at one point, didn't he? Is that not that's the story, isn't it?
Well, yeah. I mean, Rich, I was thinking, you often bring up our friend, our colleague Francois Tomazo, sort of espousing the theory that the Tour de France is generally won by time trialists. I don't agree with that. But I think that maybe that did apply once. It doesn't apply anymore simply because time trials have fallen out of favour, and well, they might fall even further out of favour for reasons we'll discuss when we talk about Chris Froome. But, you know, the number of kilometres against the clock has shrunk consistently over the years, and I don't see us going back to Grand Tours where there are 100 kilometers of time trialing over the 3 weeks.
I don't want to speak for Francois, but I don't think he was meaning that they won them because of the time trials. No. They won them more because of their capabilities as a time trialist. That ability to sustain that effort can be translated into climbing, and it's a similar, so the physiology is the same.
True. I mean, on that, time trialists typically, these sort of time trialist climbers, they typically go well on exactly the kind of stage that we saw on Sunday with a summit finish at the end of a relatively sort of benign stage. We've seen that before. We've seen it with Dumoulin, for example, at the Giro. Finally on Ghana, I mean, the only thing I can possibly envisage happening is, I talked about Moser in 1984. That was really a route that had been built for Moser to win the Giro. And, you know, Italy doesn't have a whole kind of nursery of potential Grand Tour winners sort of, you know, budding, likely to emerge at any point soon. Could RCS design a very, very uncharacteristically flat Giro to try to cater for Ghana at some point in the future? You know, that is one possibility.
just lastly on the Tour de la Provence, because, you know, one of the things that, as you were alluding to there, Daniel, is the difficulty of contextualizing these performances. I mean, Quintana's riding for a French team, a team that needs some points, wants some points to get that World Tour license, an important race and victory for them. But you can kind of look at, say, Julian Alaphilippe and use that as almost a baseline performance. And, you know, although Alaphilippe couldn't follow in the crucial moment on the final stage, no one's panicking and pulling their hair out about Julian Alaphilippe and suggesting that he's in some way, you know, off the boil or off track to be extremely good when his objectives come around a little bit later on this spring. So you can kind of put the performances against one another. I thought the other eye-catching rides were, Daniel, someone you mentioned while we were watching stage one, the Danish rider for Trek Segafredo, Mathias Skjelmose, and Movistar's duo, Matteo Jorgensen and Ivan Sosa, who's kind of come back to life after a fairly unhappy end to his time with Team Ineos. So, yeah, lots of little intriguing threads to pull out over the coming weeks of stage races as we move towards the likes of Paris-Nice and Tirreno Adriatico next month.
Can I just mention as well the Classica Jaen Paraíso, is that correct pronunciation,
Paraíso.
Daniel?
Paraíso.
Paraíso. That was a new race won by Alexei Lutsenko, who we last saw in action in the gravel race in Veneto in back in October.
There's got to be...
The poster boy of gravel racing.
There's got to be some gag, but I'm not quick-witted or sharp enough or funny enough to come up with a funny gag, but something that plays on Lutsenko and his starring role in the Astana rap and the Wu-Tang Clan's famous song, Gravel Pit. I don't know what it is.
Wow.
But the best listener gag combining those four elements will reward with a prize.
Win dinner with Daniel. But very prescribed menu and place. It was a really beautiful race to watch, though. An interesting race because it was sort of these beautiful, very, very extreme, rough gravel sections with... They were racing through an industrial estate at one point, on what looked like motorways. You could see what they're trying to do. You know, they're trying to create a southern Spanish version of Strada Bianca. And certainly some elements of it had that same beauty that Strada Bianca has. But it seemed to be, the beautiful olive groves and the gravel roads mixed up with the industrial estates and the motorways. So maybe a little bit of work to do, but a very encouraging start, I thought, for that race.
Absolutely, yeah. And let's not forget what I called him the king of gravel so far, Lutsenko, because he won La Serenissima in Italy last year. This is another level up and a kind of an equivalent to Strada Bianca, as you say. And Lutsenko's ride was impressive. I mean, he went away on his own first, and then he was caught by some other riders, including Leonard Kamnik, Connor Swift, Tim Wellens was up there as well. And there was a moment when he was coming across those slightly sort of town centre cobblestones on the final lap, I think it was, where he was tightening up his front wheel skewer whilst riding along, which was pretty impressive. I mean, get that wrong and your hands
dangerous.
In the spokes. Very dangerous,
I did that once myself. I was riding along and I spotted some dirt on my fork when I was very young, and I thought, I'll just clean that off with my finger. Hand went in the spokes. And over the bike
or
I went.
Spinaches.
They weren't spinaches, thankfully, no.
Just watching that race and watching Tim Wellens, you mentioned him there, Lionel, he was in the group behind Lutsenko. Remember we used to call Rui Costa the asparagus because he used to flourish in May and June. It struck me that maybe, I don't know, Tim Wellens could be the parsnip or something similar.
I was going to say the parsnip.
At his best at sort of end of January, beginning of Feb.
Yeah. Winter vegetable, and then goes completely off at the start of March. That's it.
Maybe instead of a rolling cassoulet, a rider should be awarded a seasonal vegetable for different parts of the season.
Well, on that subject, does Lutsenko's ride trump Brandon McNulty? Do we have a new leader in the Rolling Performance of the Year award powered by Cassoulet? I would say, I mean, I'll put it to the vote. There's three of us. Mm. We can kind of well, we've got a majority, the possibility of a majority decision, as long as Daniel doesn't sit on the fence, which I can almost already tell from his facial expression he might well
wouldn't
do. Sound fully the engaged. Tricky thing is, we didn't
wouldn't
see
sound
an
fully
awful
engaged
lot
in this competition.
We didn't see an awful lot of McNulty's ride, did we? Because there was only highlights available to watch. But basically, it was a 60-kilometer solo break in the Challenge Mallorca. I would say Lutsenko's ride was a level above that, and so
yeah,
he is the new classification leader.
If only for tightening his skewer while riding, I think that seals the deal for me. Lutsenko is going to be the on the subject of the Rolling Castellet. Is it the Rolling Castellet? That's what I'm calling it. We had a big response because the discussion last week was around could you take that award without winning? Is it possible in cycling to produce an incredible performance but not win? Well, I said no, and Will Ball wrote to agree with me on that, although he did have a couple of qualifications. But Dan Smith, Kurt Holzer and Dennis Purcell all suggested Andy Hampston on the Gavia during the 1988 Giro d'Italia. Didn't win the stage, of course, but laid the foundations for his overall win. That's a good shout. A lot and lot of nominations for Tony Martin at the Vuelta, stage 17. What year was it? The Vuelta. I can't remember that. But Tony Martin, 2013, went within 50 metres of winning a stage. Was it won by Michael Morkov, that stage? Is that correct? I think so. Tony, well, there we go. We remember Tony Martin's performance more than the winners that day, so that's a good shout. Christine Barr and Phil Walton were among the many people who suggested that. Casey Cesari suggested Egan Bernal, stage 17 of the Vuelta last year. Yeah, not a bad shout, although I guess I would remember Roglic's performance more. And Stuart Snow had a couple of nominations for Richie Porte in different races, but, you know, I still stand by my argument that really I don't think you can win the Rolling Castellet without also winning, but I guess the test will come this season.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at lower.com field. Come out and watch the crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla and Leon starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at columbuscrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
Life is a workout, and Smoothie King is here to help you power through. Whether you're crushing morning miles or sprinting through back-to-back meetings, give your body the energy, protein, and power it needs to help you conquer your goals. Only at Smoothie King.
Being out on my time trial bike this morning, and in light of also recent events, time trial bikes are not really meant to be ridden on the roads the way that we need to ride them to be ready for time trials. I mean, if there's a time trial in the Tour de France, say it's an hour long time trial, to be able to get ready for an hour long time trial, you have to get out there on the time trial bike and you have to simulate that. Now, how many roads do you know around you where you can literally ride for an hour in almost closed road conditions where there's no traffic, no stop signs, no traffic lights? Those kind of conditions just don't really exist in the real world. When you're on your skis on the time trial bike, you've got no brakes right there. You need to actually sit up. It's not really that safe. I mean, it's one thing when you're racing, when you've got closed roads. And even then, we see some pretty horrendous accidents. But it's completely another thing when you're out on open roads with traffic and people crossing the roads. So I guess the point I'm trying to make and the question I want to ask here is it really necessary for us to have time trial bikes in road cycling?
Well, chaps, I don't know about you, but when my attention was drawn to Chris Froome's latest video, and he, I don't know if he sort of made the argument for a ban of time trial bikes or just raised the possibility, I was rejoicing. I was punching the air because this is an argument I've made before. I'm not a big fan of time trial bikes, and I think the Bernal crash recently highlighted the danger. I saw some footage last week also of the Bernal crash. Colombian TV had got some CCTV footage of Bernal. It's not very clear at all, but you can see the road and you can see what happened, that Bernal rode into the back of a bus, as we know. I was quite surprised. I don't know the full detail. We did hear in the podcast from a Colombian journalist about the road in question, but it looked a busy sort of dual carriageway type road. A strange place to be time trial training, because, and people will jump to the defense of time trial bikes, I'm sure, but a lot of the time when riders are in the time trial position, their heads are down, they're not looking where they're going. And we saw also at the Olympic Games, not so dangerous on a velodrome, of course, but we saw the team pursuit at the Olympic Games, an incident where a rider just plowed into the back of another rider because he wasn't looking where he was going, didn't see the team in front of him. And it's different on a track. But nevertheless, I think in wind tunnels and so on, riders learn that often the best, most aerodynamic position is with your head down, where you can't see. And thinking back over the years to a number of incidents, remember Miguel Angel Lopez at the Giro in 2020 on day one, had a terrible crash on his time trial bike. Extreme conditions that day, very, very windy. It might have been dangerous on any bike. And on that day, the wheels were obviously a factor too. But there's no question that time trial bikes, in my mind, are more dangerous. And Chris Froome raised this very interesting point about whether time trial bikes should have a place in professional racing. Discuss.
Here's a question for you chaps. Would manufacturers continue to make them if they were banned in professional cycling? Because obviously you can't... Well, it would be extremely difficult, and I don't see by which mechanism you could do it, ban people riding time trial bikes. We can only really talk here about competition and UCI sanctioned competitions, because you know the laws of the road are different in every country, and so it's very difficult to stop people training on them or using them privately.
My question to a manufacturer, and this is something we intend to follow up on, would be how valuable is the time trial bike industry? How valuable is that market? When you think about the costs that must go into research and development, and the size of the market can't be huge. I mean, triathlons, I think they would carry on. But the bikes that use in triathlon are a bit different. They're not quite the same as time trial bikes used by professionals. So I don't know. But I wonder if it might be a bit of a blessing for manufacturers not to have to produce all these time trial bikes.
It has been pointed out by a couple of people in teams this week, Rich, that most of the technological developments in road bikes they've been birthed in the development of time trial bikes. So that's also a consideration.
I mean, first of all, the issue with the time trial bike is the aerodynamic handlebars that the riders rest their arms on means that they can't reach the brakes. And so riding them on open roads, the hazard is magnified, multiplied, because they can't easily reach the brakes. Whereas at least if you're riding fast, you know, on open roads, in and around traffic with pedestrians and other obstacles, you can reach the brakes. They're also more difficult to manoeuvre in a hurry, aren't they? You can't swerve around something whilst in that aerodynamic position as easily. And the fundamental issue is that the level of performance required in a Grand Tour time trial is such that the riders have to practice in what are pretty extreme body positions on time trials, and they won't all have access to wind tunnels to do this training, or they won't all be able to practice to the same degree on a stationary setup. They do need to practice outdoors. The issue is, you know, is the race for this kind of performance optimization overshadowing the basic principle of watching where you're going, I guess. I mean, that's the fundamental when riding on the road, is being aware of the conditions. And, you know, this is not blaming anyone for a crash, but, you know, whether racing on closed roads or training on open roads, the fundamental priority has to be safety, and then performance second. And maybe the balance between those two things is getting a little bit out of kilter. if they were to ban time trial bikes, wouldn't riders still race in extreme positions, head down, hands on the drops, not looking where they're going, trying to get as aero as possible, looking down for prolonged periods and then looking up, which we see all the time in time trials? So is there a fundamental problem with having time trial bikes, or is there a fundamental problem that the requirements of the sport are such that the margins are now so tiny that risks are taken to a greater degree? I gather that there have been some discussions between the UCI and Chris Froome about his comments, constructive discussions. Perhaps we'll hear from somebody from the UCI in the coming weeks about this, but it's a difficult one to legislate for, I would have thought, other than saying, right, take time trial bikes out of competition, then there's no need for riders to train on them, and that would certainly minimize the risk, or it would reduce the risk, I would have thought.
It's difficult though, chaps, isn't it? And people always wince slightly or find it uncomfortable when a federation or any kind of organization is being seen to put the brakes on, figuratively in this case, press the pause button on technological progress and make things, in this case, sort of slower. I mean, we've seen that with the hour record, we've seen it in other sports. In swimming, there was a period in 2008-2009 where there were 130 world records broken because of suit technology, swimming trunk technology, and they did eventually, swimming international swimming federations, they did actually in the end put the brakes on that, and they had to legislate it quite strictly. You know, we get this debate in golf all the time about that balls need to be they need to be made to not go as far. I mean, it is tricky because people are watching elite sport because to a certain extent they are signing up to or embracing that kind of Olympic motto of sort of faster, what is it, faster, higher, stronger, or words to that effect.
That's true, but is anyone watching a time trial because they're going at 53 kilometers an hour rather than 49 kilometers an hour? I don't know necessarily whether that's the case in road cycling. I certainly think that there is a precedent for banning things. I mean, the aerodynamicists of today would probably wince at the sort of ineffective designs of the past. I mean, in the 80s, there was a real leap forward because of the materials and the design capability. We saw all sorts of fairings behind saddles. We saw the spinergy wheels that you mentioned earlier, Daniel, the kind of four spokes, you know, very bladed spokes, double disc wheels, slope, you know, curved top tubes, the Spinacci handlebars. There is precedent for outlawing things on the grounds of safety. And also, I think the UCI does have a responsibility to ensure that there's a kind of a joined up line, not a sudden great jump between, you know, what mere mortals and amateurs and under 23 and junior riders can do and achieve, and what the elite end of the sport is doing. There has to be a kind of they within touching distance of one another, not just a sort of quantum leap between the technology that's available at the top and then what's available at the next level down. So I think there's a lot of different factors at play, but Chris Froome has started a debate that I think it would be healthier to have out in the open than kind of get into a ban time trial bikes, yes or no. I mean, it's more nuanced than that, I think.
Our sister podcast, Service Course, has done a great job of exploring some of these issues around the development of time trial bikes, particularly 3D printed handlebars and so on, because one of the core elements in the UCI's approach to this was that bikes must be commercially available. And we're sort of moving away from that with these highly individualized machines. Ghana, you know, Ghana on his time trial bike is certainly a thing of beauty. There's an aesthetic to time trialing that a lot of people really enjoy. And I wonder, you know, some of the things you mentioned that have been banned, the actions come quite quickly after the product's been introduced. I mean, Spinacci's, I think, lasted less than a year. Low-profile bikes came along in the 80s, didn't they, with then disc wheels and then you know, the bar extensions, triathlon bars, as they were called originally, from 1989 onwards. So you had disc wheels, low-profile bikes, the triathlon bars, all coming along in the same decade. and we're talking now about, you know, that's 30 years ago, that's 30 years these bikes have been used. It would be, it'd be strange now to turn the clock back, you know, to the early 80s, which in effect is what the UCI would be doing. Although, you know, road bikes in terms of the aerodynamics have developed a lot since then too. So I kind of applaud Chris Froome for raising this and bringing it out in the way that he's done. And I kind of would support it, I think. I don't really see it happening. But I would, as I say, be interested to speak to the people in the industry, some of the manufacturers, about the time trial bikes, because, you know, what they're interested in are bikes that are going to make them the most money, shift the most units. And gravel bikes, for example, have done that. You know, they've been kind of the other way around, where there has been a mass market developing for that very quickly, and it's now starting to be part of the professional scene too. I wonder if the balance when it comes to time trial bikes is more tilted to professional rather than the mass market.
Well, yeah, I was talking last week about how the broader ecosystem of gravel races does appeal to the manufacturers of gravel bikes. A listener emailed in, Brad Tipp, to make the very valid point that we don't see riders. Brad Tipp, Daniel, T-I-P-P.
Brad Pitt.
Yeah, and he made a very valid point that the riders don't race on gravel-specific bikes at Strada Bianca, or we didn't see any, not to my knowledge, we didn't see any in Spain the last few days where they've had a gravel-specific race and also gravel in a stage race. But it's I was kind of making the broader point that it's all part of the ecosystem. Having gravel stages and gravel races visible with the top riders riding, it does draw that link between the equipment available and the people's recognition of the brands, I guess. And so it's all feeding into that ecosystem. And I think when we see Filippo Ganna switching from a bike with disc brakes midway through a stage to rim brakes, which is a little bit lighter for that final climb to Montagne de Lure, you know, there is clearly a deep kind of technological aspect to cycling. Riders want to make tweaks mid-stages and have the most specific and most appropriate equipment available. And so these are all questions that the UCI is trying to legislate for and accommodate in real time, with trends developing all of the time. So it is a tricky one. But Froome's comments were very interesting, and it's good that somebody has raised the point, especially when it's the riders who are taking the risks. You know, no one forces them to, I suppose the sport in its way does force the riders to squeeze every bit out of themselves, whether it's in racing or training, and that does come with an element of risk. And if that can be mitigated in some way, great, and it should be. But banning time trial bikes, I'm not sure would necessarily solve this particular problem, because riders will still adopt extreme positions, and then it's a case of implementing more legislation. Then what do you penalize riders for not looking ahead of them?
The UCI
opening
have
a can of worms,
you know,
isn't it?
Yeah, last year with the banning sitting on the top tube, they've tried to outlaw certain positions, haven't they? And we should say that Chris Froome wasn't calling for a ban on time trial bikes, and if you want to hear or indeed see his comments on this, really interesting, I thought, have a look at his YouTube channel. You'll see his latest, did they call it a vlog? On his YouTube channel. And it's part of a sort of wider update from Chris Froome on his season.
We know where this is all heading. 10 years from now, it'll be everyone, the whole peloton, in a spinning studio. And before we conclude, chaps, before I forget, just a quick hop back to clarification corner, not corrections corner. Olympic motto: faster, higher, stronger. And also, Domenico Pozzoviva changed his name before he turned pro, just referring to something I said much earlier.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thanks very much indeed to Science in Sport for their support of the Cycling Podcast. If you would like 25% off all your Science in Sport products, go to scienceandsport.com and at the checkout, enter the discount code SIS CP25. Lionel, you must have got through a few Science and Sport products this week because you've done a big and quite eventful bike ride.
I did, yes. I set myself a challenge to ride two reasonably long days back to back, about 112 kilometres each way. I went to Canvey Island in Essex for reasons that, well, it turned out to be a pointless trip.
No, elude you.
Well, yeah, well, exactly, because I decided to combine it with a trip to watch my non-league football team in action, and the match was postponed because the weather on the way was absolutely terrible. Torrential rain all the way. It didn't let up at all, and so I didn't even stop for lunch. So all I had for sustenance on the way was Science in Sport products, and I was incredibly glad that I had a pocket stuffed full of the strawberry flavoured energy bake. I also had one of the Whey 20 protein smoothies and just an energy gel just to see me over the line, just as it was getting really sort of cold and miserable towards the end of my ride. And then on the way back the following day, it was a block headwind. So quite an eventful couple of days in the pre-storm weather here in the UK.
I wouldn't call a headwind in the UK eventful. I wouldn't say that constitutes, I would say that's pretty routine that it's windy in the UK.
We've also spoken about our new collaboration with MAP Clothing. So it's a great opportunity to tell us how you got on with that as well. And we should say that we've been working with MAP on some very exciting plans, which we will be revealing shortly.
We have, yeah. Well, I was wearing the Deep Winter bib tights and base layer, long sleeve base layer, and jacket and gloves. And honestly, they were similar lifesavers. I was, I was toasty warm right to the end of my ride. They got me through 4.5 hours in, as I say, pretty much non-stop and fairly heavy rain. So a big thumbs up for the winter kit. Designs conceived in Melbourne, but they can stand up to some of the worst weather that Britain can throw at them.
Well, there we go. There's the test. Before we move on, just mention an email that I got from David Yang, Artistic Director at Newburyport Chamber Music Festival. David writes occasionally and always appreciate hearing from him. Thank you, David, for your kind comments. He forwarded a blog that he's written for the Chamber Music Festival that he runs near Boston. And he mentions a cycling podcast in his blog. But one line caught my eye. He says, I know Daniel has said he hates violins, so he probably
won't
like
where this came
music.
From.
Can you put the record straight on this, Daniel?
I'm sure I've never mentioned violins in the podcast.
It's a fair assumption.
It might be, but it's wrong.
He hates everything except violins.
Anyway, let's hear from Richard Plug, the managing director of the Jumbo Visma team. I got in touch with him partly because I wanted to ask him about their new service course. I'm sure a lot of you saw the drone footage of the new service course and a sort of tour inside an incredible complex with workshops, storage, cafe, offices, conference rooms, a real not like anything we've ever seen before in professional cycling. And I was curious to ask Richard Plug about how that's come about, the planning that's gone into it. And we're not going to hear him talking about it, but he just said that it's, you know, obviously a long-term plan that they've put together, a real sign of their intent in terms of their planned longevity, but also a revenue raiser. You know, cycling teams don't tend to have physical bases. They don't have stadiums like football teams and other sports teams. This is very much intended to be a facility that brings in revenue to the team through renting offices, through holding events, through the cafe, through the shop. So a really interesting concept, and I'm hoping to be able to visit at some point and get a proper tour and find out how that's going, because it's something that teams have wrestled with forever. How do they make money out of their brand? And this could be one part of the answer. Who knows? But I also asked Richard Plug about this season ahead. You know, they've beefed up their classics team to support Wout van Aert. They've selected their Tour de France team already, which is something they've done the last couple of years. Jonas Vingegaard and Primoz Roglic in that team. And I asked him about that. I asked him about Jonathan Vauter's recent comments, where he compared Roglic to the Sean Kelly of his generation, thought he would never win the Tour de France. So I asked him about that. He also mentions Tom Dumoulin and whether he's got his mojo back to become a Grand Tour contender again, because we were wondering about that, whether Dumoulin might go in a different direction, but apparently not. And he will ride the Giro, of course, this year. We're going to hear from Richard Pluga, and then we'll come back and we'll hear from a former Jumbo Visma rider, George Bennett. But here first is Richard Pluga.
With the service course, our business peloton, which we started, has a good home, let's say, a stadium. We have room for presentations for other companies. Companies are coming to us and wants to do a presentation for their own company. So it's also been used already a couple of times for companies who want to see a cycling team as an inspirational area, let's say, and have their own meeting here in our offices. So that's also how we try to build a new business model.
You know, what do you expect from Tom Dumoulin this year? He's obviously going to the Giro. Is he going to be the Grand Tour contender of a few years ago, or can you see his career going in a slightly different direction? What do you think?
No, I believe that he can be back. The joy is back. He's really training a lot. His pace is after last year and last year's and last winter, his pace is really good again. And yeah, it's a phenomenal talent, of course. So yeah, I believe that what he did, he can still do. The time will tell, but what we see in the training and what we see in his output, he will be back at the same level. With this difference is that he is really enjoying it now, and he's making he has the steer in his own hands again, which he lost a little bit with his former team. And he's really the owner of his own life again, and that makes him really happy with what he's doing. So I believe that he might be even stronger because of that. There's no burden on him in that sense.
It was interesting what you said about the influence that Primoz Roglic had on him. To the outside world, Roglic is not sometimes the most demonstrative of people, but it's clear, from within the team, he is a very kind of inspiring leader in the way that he rides, the way that he conducts himself as well. I guess that's something you've been aware of for several years, but is it something that you've noticed? Because we noticed at the Vuelta this year, in particular, last year rather, a sort of almost a new maturity about him. I don't know if you noticed any changes in him in the last year or so.
Yeah, he's less cautious. He was already internally, I said it before probably, but the first moment I saw him in 2015, I believe it was, when we added him to the team, in the first moment, the first hour I spoke to him, I thought, oh, this is a real leader, this is an idol. And he grew in that role more and more within the team. So internally, we know this already, indeed, from 2016 onwards. But I think the last year or the year before, he also shrugged off a little bit his harness or his cautiousness in the press. And he's a little bit more open to the outside world as well. And then you see what we already saw internally for a couple of years. And yes, he's a big leader. Mm. He's a big leader.
Can he win the Tour de France? That's a provocative question, because Jonathan Vaughters recently shared the view that he sees him as a Sean Kelly of his generation, a rider who can win almost everything, but the Tour de France may elude him. He went very close, of course, a couple of years ago. Do you still believe that he can win the Tour de France?
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Very simple. But
yeah. Yeah, and I don't know who the guy was who said it, but
Jonathan Waters, yeah. That's his view. I mean, you've...
I would not recommend to have views on other riders from other teams, but anyway.
Okay.
Yeah.
You've continued this tradition of naming the tour team quite early. Vingegaal, obviously, very impressive last year. You know, having the two of them potentially going as almost dual leaders, is that do you think going to obviously increase your chances? Are there any potential problems in managing that you see, or is it something that you've spoken to both those riders about how it will work?
Yeah, of course, and that's a formula we already use for a couple of years now, that we speak a lot with everybody already in the last month, so November, December. And we as I'd like to say, we put everything on the table. We want every critic, every thought, negative or positive, we want everything on the table to have the potential to discuss it, to have the opportunity to discuss it, and to make sure that we know what the thoughts are with this or that role for someone. And that's what we did, and that's what we did in the last years. And everybody is always, at the end of a lot of discussions and a lot of talking sessions, everybody can put his autograph under the plan. So I'm really confident that we can do that in the coming tour without any problems, because we discussed all the scenarios, all the problems that might arise, etc.
Yeah, it was interesting. Jonathan Waters made that comment about Primoz Roglic in, to the cycling podcast last year, didn't he? And we put that out. It obviously didn't get didn't provoke enough of a reaction, so Waters repeated it on
JV
Twitter.
Versus JV. Jonathan Waters versus Jumbo Visma.
It's a tricky one, this, isn't it?
Also, I mean, it's talking all about self-loathing, another... really.
Talking about other people's riders is a minefield, isn't it? Really, it's never going to work out terribly well, I don't think. But I guess as journalists, it's always interesting to hear what people think of the people that they're competing against. I happen to think there's some validity to what Waters says. You know, Roglic has sort of mastered the Vuelta, but can he step up a level to do the same at the Tour de France? It's a bit like the video game where you just can't quite beat the big baddie in the final level.
I mean, the 2020 Tour, he did go pretty close, you know. It's not as if he's been a million miles away. I mean, Sean Kelly never went that close to winning the Tour de France. So it's a bit of a stretch, I think, to compare him with Sean Kelly. Also, Sean Kelly won one Grand Tour. Roglic has now won three. So I don't think the comparison is valid, but I think, you know, nobody would dispute that Roglic is capable of winning the Tour de France. Had Pogacar not been there in 2020, he would have won the Tour de France. So
I think we all agree, chaps, that one key ingredient is going to be his team. And what Richard Plugger said there, the way he justified this sort of curious policy they've got of naming the team months upstream of the Tour de France. It is intriguing, because there are teams that have an approach that's at the antipodes of that. I mean, I remember a conversation with Matt Winston of DSM at the Giro last year when we talked about this, because that is a team which has done the opposite, and they've been very cagey in the past about even saying, I remember last year they left it a long time before revealing which one of their riders was going to do which Grand Tour. And Matt Winston's answer, what he said was that, well, football teams announce their lineup an hour before a match. Why on earth would you announce your team for the most important race in the year months in advance? But having said that, Richard Plugger did give quite a convincing argument for, you know, why one would do that, with, you know, this sort of forecasting all of the imponderables that might arise and the different dynamics that might develop, and knowing in advance how each of those is going to be dealt with. I mean, it sounded there as though they have discussed the eventuality, for example, of Jonas Vingegaard proving stronger than Primoz Roglic, and they will know what they're going to do if such a scenario does arise.
And I think for the riders, it means they're not chasing results in this early part of the season, which might ultimately take away from their ability to perform at their best at the Tour. You know, those riders all know their job is to be at their best at the Tour de France.
I can completely understand telling the riders and internally announcing the team and saying, this is what we're working towards. These are the races you're going to be doing, and this is how you're going to get there to the Tour. But announcing it publicly, I don't really see the value in that, other than maybe it just stops people asking the question. I mean, that must get quite irritating as well. Who's doing the Tour? Who's doing the Giro? And it is the kind of the fodder of us in the media, isn't it? Wanting to know which riders are going to line up for which Grand Tour. It's one of the consistent storylines of the first half of the year. So maybe they just feel that even if it doesn't end up being the case, which is, you know, it didn't quite turn out to be the case, did it? Last time they named their team in advance, there was at least one change, wasn't there, before they got
Green
to
Edge
the Tour
have had
of France.
This experience as well, haven't they? Bike Exchange, what the team now known as Bike Exchange, Jayco, they did it a couple of years ago. I forget which one of the Yates brothers, but they, or Chavez, they announced who was going to lead in a particular Grand Tour, and it turned out not to be the case.
I mean, last year the Cycling Podcast announced its Tour team, and then I didn't make it. So I mean, it's fraught with difficulty, this.
It's fraught with difficulty. You think Ineos will be studying the Jumbo-Visma lineup and maybe changing their number five as a result? Who knows? Another rider who is formerly Jumbo-Visma, who hopes to be going to the Tour de France, but that's not confirmed, but that would be the plan, is George Bennett. He's moved across UAE Team Emirates. I put it to him that was a bit like moving from Real Madrid to Barcelona. The two sort of big teams likely to go, Lionel's wincing.
Hopefully,
two teams likely.
Hopefully, there are actually a lot of footballers that have done that over the years, more than people would maybe imagine. But the most famous example of that turning very sour and nasty and unsavoury was it Lionel, the Barcelona fans or the Real Madrid fans threw a pig's head on the pitch when Luis Figo turned out for the other. The other team. I hope that doesn't happen in the Tour de France. I hope we won't see pigs'
heads
flying.
Yeah, Dutch corner. I'll do it. It's George Bennett. Watch out. I don't know what kind of reception you're going to get there. A pig's
maybe
head
it's Slovenian corner on Alpe d'Huez.
A bit of Dutch beer is more likely. But it's not quite the same as cycling, is it? He spoke to me recently from New Zealand, where he is at the moment. He's coming back, on his way back at the moment, to ride the UAE Tour, his first race for his new team, and his first race alongside Tadej Pogacar. You know, really interesting to go from Roglic's side to Pogacar's side, I would have thought. And I thought it'd be interesting to ask him about those two riders, about moving teams, and much else besides. Always an interesting person to speak to, George Bennett. So here he is, looking ahead to his debut and appearing alongside Tadej Pogacar this year.
You just got throughout the week to just sort of have these nice little interactions with guys that you wouldn't necessarily do if you had to get out the door and go training that morning. So it was like, and a lot of these guys are like, you know, you naturally draw up rival lines, right? Like UAE versus Jumbo versus Ineos. And naturally, like, at least I find myself as like a tribal rider, you know what I mean? Like, it's like us versus them. And that's how, what kind of, you know, like we were a team on Jumbo and everyone was out to get us. So I only cared about the guys in my jersey. And that's kind of like how it goes against your rivals. And so you've had these run-ins with these guys where it's been your job to race against them directly because they are direct rivals. And then so you sort of have to go in, meet these new guys. And then a little bit it's like, oh, remember when we kind of had that rub up in the race? And you know what I mean? And
any awkward like, encounters in the corridors of your, I don't know, 15-star hotel.
And yeah, so in the end it was like, so I was a little bit like, oh, you know, I'm definitely coming in from the enemy's team because these guys are just, everyone's the same as me, you know, everyone. They've been UAE, and they've had to defend Tour de France titles, and I'm the new kid coming in. And straight away, there was just this real accepting vibe of like, right, you're one of us now, and it's now us versus them. And it was great. And, you know, I just got to meet guys and see guys that you'd never see, or you'd never. And there's also like an element of guys, like you might not like as competitors, but as a teammate, they're great guys. Like a good example is like in Yumbo, like I really got on well with Jos van Emden, for example. But I imagine if you had to race him, his job is like one of the protectors, you know, he would be a tough guy to race against. But as a teammate, you couldn't ask for a better guy. And so in UAE, I might be one of those examples, or there might be another bunch of examples, you know, where you actually become like these guys. Everyone's a really nice guy. Everyone's really cool. But you, if you're racing against them, you see a different side, and people see a different side of me. And so you have to sort of develop all these relationships and stuff. And I thought it was quite good to have this week where we, you know, we didn't have any pressure of having to, you know, do 5 hours and do efforts and do testing and all this other stuff. It was just pretty chilled. And you meet these guys. But yeah, I mean, I think there still is, you know, it's still really early days. I mean, I didn't do the training camp with them in January, but they'd just finished. And I think the rest of the UAE guys, like the UAE tour guys, I think they're potentially at altitude camp right now. So I'm the only one that's not doing altitude before that race. So, you know, I think the next step is to race with these guys and then really sort of start to work as a unit sort of going into the big races of the year.
And I mean, was it a wrench to leave Jumbo-Visma, because you've been there a long time, but you've also been with them on their journey from, you know, not so good to very good. So you've really been very closely identified with that jersey, with that journey and with that team. You know, it's a big deal to leave.
Yeah, and no, it was, and it really was. I mean, I came in at the ground floor when the first year Jumbo-Visma, and man, we were shit ass. We were this such a bad team. And we had, like, you know, I remember back then we were just in the sort of losing mindset a little bit, and at the end of that year, to the credit of Marijn and Mathieu and, I guess, Richard Plugger, you know, they went, right, we just have to set these outrageously ambitious goals, and they did set these goals, and we sort of went, oh, yeah, like, that's a nice PowerPoint presentation. But then we sort of started buying into them, and then we got a bit of momentum in 2016, and then we were away. After that, 2017, we really started to move quite well. I personally did, and then the team followed. 2018, we had, I think, fourth and fifth in the tour, and then, you know, it just went from there upwards. And, you know, it's been a big journey, and obviously you get to know a lot of people in 7 years, and if you don't make good friends in 7 years, then, you know, well, you might be the asshole in that situation, you know.
You presumably wouldn't have stayed there for 7 years if you...
Yeah, exactly. Friends, so. Yeah, I would have left a long time ago. But yeah, well, it was tough to leave, but I think it was only tough temporarily until, you know, it was tough until, like, the tough part was, you know, I'd left Jumbo and hadn't started with UAE. You know, so I was still doing races with Jumbo or whatever, but I wasn't really, you know, I definitely knew I was on the out now. I was leaving. And I didn't really have, like, this, you know, like, I was still getting trained by my coach and I was still, you know, whatever. But I didn't you know, like, in my head, it was really hard to think, okay, I'm not working on anything for the future here. This is just doing my time through this part. And then, you know, and then once I started now in sort of December, got home to New Zealand, it's been great. And I haven't really given it a second thought, actually.
And I mean, as you mentioned earlier, you're kind of going from, you know, if it was football, it would be, you know, Real Madrid to Barcelona sort of thing. You know, you're going from one Tour de France favourites team to another. I mean, was there an element of Jumbo-Visma being kind of sensitive to that, to being very aware that you would be, you know, taking their secrets with you? And from UAE's point of view, have they been keen to sort of learn a bit about how Jumbo-Visma operate, or does it not really work like that?
It's a good question. I thought it would be like that, but no, not at all. UAE, it's, you know, that they... I think they're just really confident in their systems, and they didn't, not once have I, you know, not, they know exactly exactly how I trained on Jumbo because they had my training peaks, and they went, they looked through everything obviously and go, we don't, you know, looking at our testing of you, we don't believe this is the best way forward for you. And I'm just, you know, I'm backing in my new trainer, you know, and really, I obviously have input into it and say, you know, great communication with him and say, this is what I feel, this is, yeah, but, you know, I've got a new nutritionist who's really, like, onto it, and he didn't ask how I ate, he sort of, you know, how we did it before. I mean, a little bit, but not really, you know, like it wasn't like, okay, you hear, tell us all the secrets. There's been no secrets, because I think all the things that Jumbo did, they made quite a song and dance about them. They weren't, you know, it wasn't, they had to have a reputation about being absolutely cutting edge, which they are. I mean, they were non-compromising with like, one of their biggest advantage, I think, was aerodynamics, and that was all Mathieu Hebor. And he was doing, you know, like when Shimano couldn't produce a fast enough wheel, they didn't think twice about going and buying a Vision wheel or an Aero Coach wheel, or, you know, and they just went and bought them. And sort of it was ultimatum to the sponsors, you know, until you can make it this fast, do it. And so the whole world could see that, you know, because they showed up to a race with Aero Coach wheels or Vision wheels. Or, you know, they tell everybody about the Food Coach app.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it was helping sell Jumbo products. Or even things like ketones, you know, every cycling news article.
Yeah, they're pretty transparent, weren't they?
Very transparent.
That's probably a legacy of Rabobank as well, I think. You know, I think that came from,
yeah, I think so,
from Pluga as well.
I think so. I think Richard took over in a great way and has gone, right, we're going to just be, you know, I remember it with the training camp thing, you know, and there was the incident with the sleeping pills on training camp with Lombardo, and that, you know, they just went, right, we're going to front foot this. This is what's happened at our camp. And I thought, you know, it's a very, like, noble thing, and I think it's served them really well. But what I guess it, you know, trickle-down effect is that there's not really secrets on Jumbo in terms of their speed comes from their equipment, from good trainers, and from huge investment into nutrition, into aerodynamics, and to altitude camps, you know. So everybody knows that, and it's nothing. And UAE have gone, right, well, we have great equipment, we have altitude camps, we have an unreal nutritionist who's, you know, the attention to detail that I'm getting here now is, you know, infinitely more involved than it was, you know, in the last few years for me. So there's nothing really new on that front, and I guess it's sort of to the discretion of trainers how they tweak their athletes. But what I'm sort of realizing pretty quickly is, like, there's many ways to get strong, and basically if you're quite good and you ride your bike a lot and you ride it hard, you're going to get to a pretty good level. And then what I guess we're trying to do is the last 2%. So you basically rearrange everything from the start to try and get, you know, the end result is, you know, you do all this different stuff now so that you can be 2% better when you need to be. You know, let's say you build a bigger base, or you, whatever. And so it's really hard for me to say, like, oh, this is working really well for me and I'm flying, because sometimes it's a long-term goal to get better and to work on all these weaknesses. And, you know, you might be neglecting the stuff, like the stuff that would bring you up in a couple of weeks of training that can really spike your form hard. And you're just saving that, and then you do it. And then when you do it, you come up even higher. But yeah, so it's really early to say on the training front, but I think when you compare the overall thing from resources, from, you know, nutrition, from equipment, from aero testing, from, I just really think that, you know, Jumbo have got this great reputation because maybe they were early adopters of it and they got a lot of credit for it. But I think you'll find in pro cycling teams now with a good budget, it's happening everywhere, you know.
Imagine you are riding the tour and helping Pogacar, and he's up against Roglic, and it's a battle between them. Would that be strange for you to be up against your old team and you know, having to do a really important job?
Oh, I think I would really froth on that. I think that would, you know, that would really, I would really think that I would love that situation, and I think that will be a situation. You know, it's a really likely situation because, you know, you've got Primoz and that whole jumbo team, and they've, you know, they've gone their way, I've gone mine. And it is kind of the ultimate rivalry, isn't it? The two Slovenians going at it, probably the two favourites. And, yeah, I think I would really relish the opportunity to, you know, to just for the love of competition. That I like cycling so much. I love racing. I love the sort of drama of it, that there is this, you know, it's almost poetic, right? The two best cycling GC riders going head-to-head. And there is some kind of, you know, just for that to be a situation. And I'm sure I'll have to have a pretty important role in guiding them through the mountains there. And, you know, I won't think twice about having to, you know, I won't feel bad for the jumbo, just like they wouldn't feel bad for me, you know, if they beat me, you know. So it's all sort of professional and stuff, but it's also like, you know, I don't know, it's kind of, you want to, it's like when you, for a very strange analogy, the only one I can think of off the top of my head, but imagine you, you know, after a relationship breaks up, you know, you want to be the one that moves on well and has the happy family and not the one that's an alcoholic down the down at the pub.
So yeah, the Invisma, your exes, yeah.
Exactly.
I'll let you go, George, but I wanted to ask you about those two Slovenians. I mean, Roglic, obviously really key to that journey that Jumbo-Visma have been on. I mean, what can you say about Roglic, having ridden and worked closely with him? What, you know, in a sentence or two, what impressions do you leave the team with of Roglic himself as a person?
Well, I guess the crazy thing is I don't have a huge insight into him, which almost says quite a lot, you know. Other than he's a really nice guy. Like, I really have a lot of respect for him. I really think he is so measured, which is maybe his biggest sort of quality. He's measured, reserved, you know, thinks about things, but, you know, at a distance, always. Which was probably the stark contrast, you know. Whereas, you know, and so I think that he, you know, he's one of the toughest guys in the sport, and, you know, I really enjoyed my time riding with him. But, you know, you'll, like, some guys you get home from a race and you'll even be on the phone with them and a few days later and, you know, chatting about this and the next one and this and that. But, you know, we just had a really good relationship that was at bike races, and I really, you know, respected how he was a leader. And whereas I think today's Pogacar, you know, I mean, I don't know him super well, but he's youthful. He's more sort of there for a good time, you know, and just happens to be really good at it, you know. And I think that someone summed it up pretty well when he's like, basically like, oh, he's a kid that, you know, he still is a kid that is just really good at bike racing, but in times of stress, he's just got the coolest head on him you can ever imagine from a guy that age. And, again, such a nice guy. So I think I'm very fortunate that I didn't have to do too much time working for assholes. And, you know, from my impression of today, I'm really looking forward to working with him going forward. And that can be a rare thing, you know. I think cycling, it's a little bit like tennis, you know, you have to be a bit tweaked to be quite good at it. But, you know, fortunately, I've been in these positions where, you know, I've been around good guys and there's been these good environments, essentially. So, yeah, I think there's definitely a marked difference between the two, and people will always try and ask, you know, or compare one between the other, but I think, you know, very different people, but both great guys.
Surely, Richard, if we're going to do football analogies, we ought to get them right. Team UAE ought to be Manchester City Manchester City, owned by Sheikh Mansour of the United Arab Emirates, of course. And, of course, the sort of new money in football, aren't they? Which UAE Team Emirates are in the last couple of years.
PSV Eindhoven.
Oh, God. This is
well, it's a
Ajax.
Tricky one, that, because in soccer, the Dutch teams are kind of, you know, faded glory, trying to get back to their best days, whereas Jumbo Visma are kind of at the cutting edge, aren't they, at the moment? So I don't know. I guess a Dutch version of, one of the Galacticos, I suppose, but a Dutch version, struggling a bit there.
Before you wrestle us back to
the
cycling
Los Angeles
rich.
Rams.
Yeah. But just before you wrestle us back to cycling rich, I should inform the listeners that it was Luis Figo was playing for Real Madrid. And if you want to see the Barcelona fans pelting him with a pig's head, then the clip is on YouTube.
I feel like this should go without saying, but you know, we obviously don't want to see anyone pelting the riders with any kind of meat products.
We don't condone that. Pig's mask.
If you're bringing spare meat products to the Tour de France, I'll let you know where I'll be. You can just hand them. We'll have an amnesty on meat products.
The giant Castle that will be awarded to the rider with the performance of the year at the end of the year.
Excellent.
I mean, George Bennett, excellent there on lots of things. The strangeness of joining a new team, becoming teammates and friends, I suppose, with riders he'd previously battled with. I liked his mention of Jos van Emden as somebody who he'd loved being a teammate of, but suspects he wouldn't like being an opponent of. And it's one of the interesting dynamics about professional sport, I suppose.
I've heard that about a few riders in the past. Fletcher was another one. People said that about Terpstra is another one.
And obviously, UAE Tour is a big race for him and Tadej Pogacar. It would have been more interesting had Egan Bernal been riding it as planned. This would have been a first meeting between Pogacar and Bernal. Sadly, that will not now happen. And a lot of the interest now is on the sprinting, isn't it? Because it's a real star-studded sprint field. The only rider missing, Fabio Jakobsen, really, of the top-class sprinters, who we've already seen winning this year. Sorry, Lionel. So anyone
well,
else
Caleb
missing?
Ewan as well missing for the first time in a while. He's going to do Kerner, Brussels Kerner instead. Mm. And obviously Gaviria, of course, now out. So,
Sorry, I'll take it back. But Cavendish, Dylan Groenewegen, various others. It's going to be quite an interesting race from a sprinting point of view.
Yeah, I think there are going to be some very clear winners and losers among the sprinters, because it's such a deep field with Sam Bennett riding for Bora, Demar there with his full lead out train, or a pretty good lead out train, Groenewegen, as you say, Rich, and someone I think is going to come home with a bit of a bloody nose among the sprinters, or cut down to size. And you know, we talked last week, won't go into it now in detail, but this question of Quickstep Alpha Vinyl and which of their sprinters are they going to take to the Tour. We think it's probably going to be Jakobsen, but Cavendish looked fantastic, I thought, in Oman. He only really got the opportunity to really unwind his sprint on one occasion, and he won that day. The other couple of stages he was sort of impeded, but you know, if Cavendish wins two stages and beats the likes of Groenewegen and Bennett in the UAE, he's also going to have their sort of A-team lead out in the UAE. Well, he's going to have Michael Morcu, so that might sort of muddy the waters even more.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think his sprint training in Oman was slightly makeshift. We saw him remonstrating with his teammates at a couple of finishes. I thought he was unlucky, but I also thought Richesi was unlucky on the final stage in Oman. Richesi was relegated in the end for impeding Cavendish. Cavendish was very, very cross, but Richesi had been acting as lead out man, but he was still sprinting, because he was still, you know, he was still right up there, so it wasn't as if he'd peeled off and taken Cavendish out. He was still sprinting for the line, and you know, there was a gap there. Cavendish, it was maybe a little bit too small for Cavendish to go through, but it seemed a racing incident rather than any kind of irregular sprinting, really, from Richesi there. I thought he was a bit unlucky.
What do you chaps expect on the overall? Is it going to be another the now sort of annual Pogcineration in the desert. Very important race, of course, for Team UAE. Or, I mean, I expect Adam Yates as he was last year. Adam Craig David Yates, the master of seven-day racing. I expect him to be very strong and possibly to be Pogacar's biggest threat.
Yeah, Joao Almeida as well is riding, which is interesting, isn't it? Because if he was on a different team, you'd expect him to be his biggest rival. It all looks set up for a Pogcineration. Despite his recent COVID, he seems to be recovered, and don't expect anything. It's difficult looking at the start sheet to see any real opponents for Pogacar there.
Just lastly, before we wrap up on the Tour of Oman, because Quickstep Alpha Vinyl, as you would expect, are, well, as soon as Richard said it's been a barren old start to the season for them, they've won here, there and everywhere, haven't they? They've won more races than anyone else. I thought Fausto Masnada's win was impressive. But a quick word for Uno X as well, because they've been doing very well. We heard from their young Norwegian rider, Tobias Halland Johannesson, who won a stage of the Etoile de Bessèges last week. And they got a bigger win, really. Anthony Charmig won a stage of the Tour of Oman, and Jakob Hinsgaal won the Tour of Antalya in Turkey as well. So they're going really well early doors in the season. Early doors, indeed. Sorry. Red card for that, sorry.
Indeed, indeed. Well, listen, chaps, we better wrap it up because I've got to get a train from Watford. A very brief, fleeting visit, but it's left a very powerful impression on me, Lionel.
You can't leave after 12 noon, Richard. That's just the rule. You're stuck here now.
Well, my train is delayed, so that may well be true. Anyway, thank you very much. We'll be back next week. I'm sure we'll be following UAE Tour next week. We're going to have a couple more interviews next week with big hitters from the cycling world. Until then, thank you very much, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard. Thanks for coming to Watford. I really appreciate it. I feel honoured. There'll be a blue plaque on this building one day, I think.
Thank you, Daniel.
Thank you. Ciao.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.